I think you're overthinking it. I just wanted to dramatically start this episode of the podcast. I've almost completely lost my voice because I had a bunch of super fun shows over the weekend in Atlanta and Nashville. And so there's quite a bit of, there was quite a lot of hours on stage singing silly songs and doing the stand-ups. So I'm just a teensy bit horsey right now. I think I'm over-talking it is what I was doing and probably what I'm doing now. So I'm just going to tell you really quickly that there's more stand-ups in the future, August 15 and 16, Soul Joles in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Also August 22 and August 23 at Levity Live in Huntsville, Alabama. And again, I'll be there with my bestest friend, Mike Furman. We'll see you down there. And you can, follow me on the socials at Hardwick, Instagram, TikTok. I'm really trying to make TikTok work. I'm just not good at it yet. But if you want to see a Gen Xer try to figure out TikTok, then it's a good follow. Really quickly, before we get into this episode, I just want to say thank you for last episode. Last episode was the first new one in 3 years. And it went really well. I just want to say thank you. People seem to enjoy it. A lot of people seem to download it, and I just want to say thank you. That really means a lot to me. I didn't know it was going to happen. I mean, you know, it was just going to be a couple of months, you know, after the baby was born, a quick parental leave that turned into a long 3-year parental leave. And so, I didn't know if anyone was going to listen. I was a little nervous. Even though I know we shouldn't focus on the result, I am very happy and thankful for the result. So I just want to say thank you. Thank you if you had listened and continue to listen. Thank you if you're new and have just recently subscribed or just started listening. I really appreciate you. So thank you, thank you, thank you. This episode is Sparks, the band, who have returned to the podcast. They were on during the pandemic. Ron and Russell, who are just the sweetest and such a great band. Really, if you've not seen the Sparks Brothers documentary that Edgar Wright directed, it is phenomenal. They are phenomenal. During pandemic, obviously, I had to do this via Zoom, and I was so happy that I got to actually shake hands with them in person. But they were such a wonderful conversation about just moving forward. And you know, you may overthink, but you're gonna push through it anyway. And that is what they have done for like 50 years. They're on a massive world tour right now, which you can see on their website, allsparks.com. And if you get the chance to see them live, you should. Edgar posted some photos on his Instagram of their show, one of their shows. And it was so fun and like packed to the gills with people. And I'm really happy for them. I'm really, really happy for them. They absolutely deserve all the success that they're getting. And it's really, really fun to watch. If for some reason you cannot watch them live or they're not performing in or near a city where you live, then by all means, get their new album, Mad, which is available now. It came out last month in May. It's fantastic. Really, really, really fun. And we'll talk about that in the podcast as well. So go get the album wherever you get your music, listen to the podcast, then listen to Sparks, Mad, or any of their, you know, over 24 other albums that they have. You could really go down the Sparks rabbit hole. But again, start here on the podcast first. Follow them on Instagram, Sparks_official. And that's it. I'm going to start the thing now. Okay, start the thing. Still just me. Good to see you guys in person, because you were on the old version of the podcast, but it was Zoom. It was Zoom style. Yeah. We kind of did it pandemic style.
Yeah, yeah. Zoom style in the good old pandemic days.
Yeah.
our baby was born in 2022, and she just missed
I'm so glad that she just has no sense at all. And when I think back now, like, holy shit, that was half a decade ago. It just, the time dilation.
No, it's amazing.
It's very bizarre.
Yeah.
Do you run into people and you go, oh, I don't think I've seen you for like 2 years. And they're like, no, it's been like 6 years.
Yeah. And you kind of judge the time on when COVID started, kind of.
Yeah.
Speaking of films.
Yes.
At the Cannes Film Festival, we had to go get tested daily for
COVID.
So that's a marker in time for us where, you know, it was a strange festival that year where it was sort of trying to make make things go ahead as normal. But every day you'd have to go and they had a special testing booth. And so all the, you know, all these stars would be behind you, standing there, spitting on you. Yeah,
it was the only festival too, a Cannes festival that was in the summer, because they shifted it later.
Yeah.
To kind of try to avoid some of the COVID time.
Sure.
So there was kind of this weird window at that time where it was kind of okay, and then before that was bad, and after that was bad.
So. I wonder if there were certain celebrities who were like, can I get to the front of this line? Just like people who aren't used to waiting in lines. Like,
yeah.
Everyone's got to do this.
That's right.
Is that a velvet rope? This is a legitimate medical situation.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know how. I feel like we're going to bore our child someday. If she complains about something, I'll be like, oh, before you were born, they had to jam a 2-foot cotton swab up and take a snippet of your brain.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Was that what they were doing? Were they doing the nose test?
Yeah. And you know, there's everybody's, you know, there's Kate Blanchett's snot was in the thing, the little, it was,
you
like
sell that for a lot on eBay.
No, I know. Well, we grabbed a couple.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. But they were, they had it. It was kind of weird where they kind of, you threw your discards in this little, communal tin, you know, but it's France, you know, so it's kind of, oh, c'est la vie.
How long, I feel like it was maybe 2021 that I talked to you. Was that when Edgar's movie came out? It was like 2021?
I think it was. It was, yeah.
So how long after that did you go, oh, I think we can go back out on the road? And because obviously that's a moment you want to seize. So when did you feel comfortable getting back out?
We were kind of working a lot during the whole COVID time. And then the movie, actually both Edgar's documentary and also Annette, the movie musical that we did, they both came out kind of it wasn't planned that way, but they just came out at around the same time. And it was just kind of after things started to ease up a bit with COVID. And so then we did go on tour. We had some touring plans, but then they got postponed. But during that time, we recorded an album. We made wanted to make use of the time.
Yeah.
And just kind of moan about how terrible everything is at that period during COVID, which it was. But we
still do that.
There was a legitimate reason back then. Now I feel like it's fun to invent catastrophes.
Well, we don't have to do much invention.
Do you, do you normally kind of isolate when you're recording?
We do. We really work kind of in a bubble in a certain sense. And we're really lucky because other people kind of leave us alone when we're working, and they're generous enough to, you know, pretty much accept what we do. I mean, it was a real difference between working on our things and then working with on a movie, because that's such a collaborative thing and you kind of have to give up control, which we're very big on control, but with a film, at least if you trust the director and what you're doing, it kind of makes it easier to kind of just be a part of a team.
Yeah, it is. But not only are you giving up control when you're working in a collaborative environment, but also, is there anything about when you release an album, do you sort of make peace with the idea that, like, well, it's not really ours anymore, because once you put it out, people are going to attach their own ideas, their own identities, their own interpretations of things. And it really is sort of just, how good are you at just sort of releasing that into the world?
Yeah, because I mean, so much of it at that point is, it is, like you said, out of your control, and you've done everything you possibly can to make it be as good as it can be. And then that's when it sometimes gets frustrating, when, you know, there's, you want to see everybody else do some of the heavy lifting after you've, you know, worked for a year or however long on an album. And so, but it gets out there in the world, and then you just hope, you know, hope and pray for the best.
Like the release of Mad exclamation point.
The exclamation point is actually we had a lot of board meetings to discuss that, because it was,
the recording went really quickly. Yeah. It was just deciding on whether that exclamation point should be there after Mad.
Those are the little things that you don't think are going to monopolize a lot of your time. But if you really let yourself start to obsess over those details, which I imagine you do,
we did.
Of course.
Then it's like, fuck, is it a semicolon? Is it an exclamation point? Is there nothing? Is it like a, what's the font? Like,
no, a lot of artists just would have left it at Mad, but you know, we took the extra step and, you know, a couple of weeks of, the font for the exclamation mark and making sure it was right. But yeah, we did some group testing, you know, to see marketing, you know, see if,
sure,
do you like the exclamation mark, or do you prefer it without it? And it was unanimous to keep it.
Yeah. I'm curious, because when the Sparks Brothers documentary came out, it really did seem to, I will ask before I assume, did it kind of blow things up for you in a way that you had hoped it would?
It did. I mean, I don't know if blowing up is kind of the extent of what happened, you know, or whether it's kind of over, you know, a bit exaggerating it, but it really changed both the perception of a band, but also just who was kind of coming in new to see the band. There are so many people that became Sparks fans after just seeing the Edgar Wright documentary. And, you know, we're so proud of that, because there are people that are coming in without kind of, you know, we're appreciative of people that have stuck with us through the years, obviously. But the thing that's most satisfying for us is people just approaching what we're doing now and kind of appreciating it for what it is, almost like a new band. So things really change, and we can kind of see one thing that we enjoy about touring is that we're able to see, you know, firsthand the difference in the audience. There are quite a few more younger people coming to see us, and it's really inspiring.
Yeah, because I think one of the fun things about discovering a band is usually like, oh, they have a couple of albums that I can go back, but you have decades worth of music that people can really go down a rabbit hole and track, you know, track the progress.
Yeah, and it's also really changes the focus too, with newer fans and younger fans that have come into the Sparks fold via the documentary. They don't have so much of the baggage of, that was the golden era of Sparks, or that was the golden era. They kind of are, what they're hearing now, the latest album is kind of represents what Sparks is. And then they kind of go back and discover the past. And sometimes, you know, albums that, you know, older fans that have been with the band, they think, well, that's the classic.
Sure.
They go, well, they don't even understand why someone will like an album like, you know, Come On to My House, where that was the album that, you know, a lot of people cite, their reference point is where they came in now. And so we think that's just really, really healthy, for at least healthy for Sparks.
It's funny you say that, because I if you ask anyone, like, oh, what was the, it kind of reminds me of when you're talking about Saturday Night Live, and people go, well, no, this was the best cast. Yeah. They go, no, it was Farley. Well, I don't know, I really like the Billy Crystals. It's like, whenever you discovered it, it was kind of, that was your entry point.
I'm sad to say, but John Belushi is my standard.
Well, that, yeah. That, I mean, going back, but you guys have been around for the same period of time, so you have this, sort of parallel, like, you know, all these different entry points.
And even like Edgar, the director of the documentary, his entry point wasn't from the very beginning. It was around the late 80s and early 90s for the number one in heaven album, kind of more electronic album. So he kind of had to dig into the past. So, you know, you kind of assume that people that are real fanatics about you started early on, but it isn't always the case. And so, you know, it kind of is really good for us, you know, doing our live shows, because we can kind of draw from so many different eras, but it all becomes kind of just one, you know. And I think also the way things are presented now, you know, with, you know, for better or worse, on Spotify and streaming services, that there isn't so much of a historical thing about any catalog. It's all a part of one long continuous string of music.
of you know? Singles that just sort of like, oh, I guess these are on different albums. But that, I guess, have you ever sat down and created like your ultimate Sparks playlist, where it's like, these are the 20 songs from the entire catalog that you would...
Well, that's the problem. That's what we have to do now. We're going on tour starting in late May and in June. And so it's when we have now 28 albums with the new Mad album, the exclamation mark. And so normally a set of ours works out around 21 or 22 songs. So if you have 28 albums, then obviously if you're doing the math, you're going to be having to not represent live a few of those albums. So picking the songs that you do like the ultimate playlist for this particular tour, it becomes a, you know, kind of a challenge. But then the flip side is the Sparks fans in general really like to be surprised of what you pick. So we kind of like now trying to kind of dig deep into some of the albums that maybe went a little bit more under the radar and pick songs from those albums too to do live. And so the ultimate playlist kind of changes daily. But
can I pitch an idea?
Sure.
Just a random idea. Might be terrible, but I think as a Sparks fan, I think it would be really fun. So you do the set, but then you do one song that's a medley of songs that didn't quite make the playlist. So it's like a medley, like a 4-minute supercut of snippets of like 6 or 7 songs. You're like, they were really close, but they didn't, but we did decided to go in this other direction. But here's our runner up playlist.
Well, we haven't started the tour yet. So it will bear that in mind, you know, but yeah.
Come and see us and see if we took you up.
Oh my God. I would love to. Are you playing at the Greek in LA, right?
Yeah. On September 30th, we're at the Greek here. And then
fantastic.
Starting a world tour in May. We started in Japan this time, and then all of Europe and the UK, and then back to the States in September.
How much responsibility do you feel toward the new album versus like, well, I know, you know, you're sort of saying when we kind of mold the playlist, you know that that longtime fans are going to want to see different things. So what's your philosophical approach to like, well, obviously we're going to promote the album because that's what we're doing, but also kind of servicing, you know, these other 27 albums.
Yeah, it's a difficult kind of situation, but we really like to feature quite a few of the songs from the new album. I mean, not in a publicizing kind of way, but we enjoy kind of playing songs that we've never played before, and we feel really strongly just about what we've done lately. So you know, so many bands that have been around as long as we have, they kind of feature so much of their older material. But our preference would be to kind of lean more towards the newer things.
Yeah.
But we try to strike a balance because people are coming, you know, I mean, it's only slightly pandering, but people come to see songs maybe that are their favorites from the
sure.
past. And you don't want to kind of cheat those people and say, we're only doing new things. I'm sorry, you know, I mean, they deserve, you know, something as well. And so it's, you know, it's a broad thing, but we do always, when we have a new album, feature quite a few of the new song. Like an album for us is never just a kind of a passport to being able to do a tour. It's always that's the main feature of what we are now. And so it's important for us to play a good representation of the new album.
You can always pretend that you're taking requests. You can say, oh, can we take any requests? I believe I heard Dick Around.
Yeah,
you know, it's like,
no,
even if you didn't, it's like they're not going to, it's a big stadium, they're not going to know.
No, we haven't been above doing that.
No, no.
Thank you. I believe this was the song that was requested, and then you can just play whatever you want.
Yeah.
People are like, oh my God, they're taking requests.
You guys are crazy. You're just nailing it every
time. Okay, well, give it a shot.
So you say you play 21 or 22 songs. Energetically, how is that? Are you playing shows every night? Like, what's the sort of physical taxation process now for your live shows?
It's funny you should mention that. We've just been going over that with our manager because we like to have, you know, it usually works out. We do two shows in a row and then there's a day off, but the day off is usually traveling to the next city. So the day off isn't really a day off. So we've had this long discussion about days off that aren't really days off. And so like we had discussion today was it's nine and a half hours drive to get from Milan, Italy, where we're playing to Toulouse, France. And how is that going to work? The rest of the band, they go via, this is a really technical stuff.
No, listen, I love the process.
This is really boring.
No.
I'm going to bore you now. So the band, they go on a bus, and after each gig, they get on the bus. It's a really nice bus and has these bunks and everything, and then they travel overnight to the next city. So they're already there, but Ron and I are kind of wusses, and after our shows, we kind of like staying in just a hotel in that city where we've just played, so we don't have to get on a bus and drive.
By the way, you're not wusses. I tried to do a bus tour of stand-up once. My wife and I were like, it's going to be great. We're going to have this bus, and it's going to... And we did the same thing. We ended up like, we'll just take us to the hotel because you're like this the whole night, and you start to feel a little trapped. Yeah. And I was like, you know, if I was 25, maybe this would have been like a crazy fun road trip. But now, comfort really wins.
Yeah. So if any of our band guys are watching this, that way of going is really cool. It's probably the best way.
Yeah.
But we go this other way. So that's when we have the problem becomes that we have the 9.5 hour drive from Milan to Toulouse in France. And then you say, well, why don't you just take a flight? But there's apparently, the flights are, you have to make connections
because
there's no good way. So that ends up being almost 9.5 hours by the time you get to airports and change. So see the dilemma that we're
driving, honestly, if you're only talking about saving like an hour or so, you know, especially when you go through airport security and then you have to worry about your stuff, like making the connecting flights. And if any of the flights get canceled, then
you're screwed.
You're screwed. And that extends that whole thing. So the actual 9.5 hour road trip wear and tear wise, which I think is you have to be on stage every night delivering these 21, 22 songs. So the wear and tear of and keeping comfortable is pretty vital if you're going to want to do those shows.
No, it is. And, you know, it's a pretty, vibrant show and everything. And then you just want it to be good for people that have come because every audience, you know, each one is important and we try to do a good show. So all that enters in the picture. And obviously the audiences never see that, but, you know, you just, you show up and it's like, hi, here we are again, you know, but damn, 9.5 hours on the Italian strada or whatever it's called.
We also have it. I mean, it's actually tougher on Russell because our songs are kind of structured with almost 99% vocals. So there's no kind of break for him during the live set. You know, I mean, it wasn't intentionally that way, but that's just kind of the way it turned out.
It really sucks.
So most, a lot of bands have, okay, guitar player, take it. But we don't have a lot of those moments. And it's a workout for him.
But you probably have I would imagine in building your playlist, you're like, you have the songs that are the most rest.
Yeah, exactly.
That they can be. So it's like intense, lean back a little bit, a little more intense, and you're kind of mapping like a heat map of intensity.
And then we have this one thing now where, well, Ron does has been doing in the past. We've done this song called Shopping Mall of Love, and it's Ron kind of speaking on on this one piece. So that gives me like 3.5 minutes to kind of stand in the background, and kind of that's my rest for the entire show. But and so on the new tour, we picked another song that, because we didn't want to do Shopping Mall of Love again on this tour. So there's another song, and Ron's going to get up and do his thing for, so I get 3.5 minutes to stand there and recuperate, and then go back for another 45 minutes or whatever's left of the show.
Do you do shows consecutive nights, or do you give yourself a couple days off?
There's usually two in a row, and then the one day off that's the non-day off, really, because you're still moving around. So it's, yeah. So the back-to-back shows are, you know, the second night is, you know, sometimes they're grueling. But, it's always fun, though. Yeah. You know, when you're doing it, you know, you don't think about, you know, being tired or any of that, because they're super fun.
Also, we love being tourists as well, so we usually get less sleep than we might, because we want to get up early in the morning and just walk around the city. So,
yeah.
You're there, and it's, you know, it's a great chance to really see places that you've never seen before.
Oh, that's amazing. I used to have that philosophy, but now when I'm performing in a city, I gave up on that a while ago. So I'm like, you know what? I'm too tired. We have a 3-year-old. I'm usually on stage when I would normally be way in bed.
Yeah.
So I just kind of give myself the free pass to be like, I'll explore Chicago next time.
Yeah. It's a dilemma.
That's kind of a wise decision, but we're not quite as wise.
Do you feel, this is kind of a, I don't know, sort of a weird question, I guess, but I guess in sort of talking about the last time I talked to you guys, there was a lot about like defining success and satisfaction and, you know, sort of finding balance and being happy with where you are. Do you feel more grounded now, or do you feel more like we did it, you know, we achieved this thing that we were always after?
Well, I think part of it now is because there is more visibility for Sparks probably than there's been any time in our career, which is really odd after this point in our career. But then you kind of want to keep the level of what you're doing, really the quality of what you're doing really, really high, you know, so then it becomes a thing that you want to keep making sure that the new albums are really good, you know, and so that becomes a chore, because you don't want to disappoint people that have come on board or the people that have been following you for a long time. So that becomes the challenge after now 28 albums to kind of present what you're doing and can, you know, keeping the universe that you've kind of created with Sparks, but to find kind of new ways to present that. And so that becomes the challenge. And so with more knowing that there's going to be more focus on you because there's been more success recently, it kind of is a mixed blessing in a way, you know? And so now the kind of, we feel the pressure is more on to kind of to deliver.
Also, every single time you have the fear, am I ever going to be able to do this again? I mean, you would think that after so many songs and albums and tours that you would have some confidence in your ability to come up with new material, but it's always kind of running on fear. And I mean, it's a good motivator, but I would kind of like to kind of settle in at some point.
Yeah, but I think that's also part of the lie of anxiety, where you're like, oh, I think something's wrong. No, I don't know. You get anxiety. No, but this time it really, you know,
yeah.
The same thing with the creative process, I guess, where it's just exactly what you said. Oh, I don't know. I know before I thought that and it worked out okay, but this could be the time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Do you, because I guess I would, sometimes I would want to impart to creative types, like if you need to, if you know that's a part of your personality, maybe you just embrace that as part of the process.
Yeah.
And don't beat yourself up about it, but just go, I know I'm going to have this moment where I question everything and I'm going to go, I can't do it. But then somehow you squeak through. Do you feel like that it's habituated or almost superstitious in a way? Like, oh, I need to feel that anxiety to make sure that I'm honoring my process.
I guess you could see it as some form of superstition that you kind of do need that kind of situation to kind of motivate you. And because it's hard to kind of psych yourself into thinking, don't worry, this will be okay, because it's been okay in the past. It always, yeah, it, what you mentioned, just, well, but this time, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's always that worry. But I think it's good because it kind of, you know, I think some people, I envy them for their kind of peace within themselves, but we don't have that. And so I think that anxiety is something good for what you're doing in the future. It's not good for you personally.
No.
But it's good for your output.
And you probably have the same feeling when you know, the thing of just before going on a stage and going, oh my God, like, why? It's so surreal, the whole concept of throwing yourself out in front of a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And being exposed in that sort of way, and just before going on stage each time, it's like you go, oh my, why am I subjecting myself to this? And then you get out there and you go, oh well, this is why, because
yeah,
it's really cool to be communicating with that many people and stuff.
Yeah, and you really, and especially when you have a fan base like you have, you're really having a conversation with your audience. Like, they're there because they've, you know, some of them have been on a journey with you for a really long time, and some of them have just discovered you. But at the end of the day, it isn't even just your music. I think it's you and your whole story. Like, it really is like, I think you really have this great, interesting community of fans, rather than just some bands where it's like, oh, they're up on a pedestal and the audience is sort of back here. You know, I'm curious to know if you see it this way, that you and your fans are all on this journey together.
Yeah, I think there's this feeling almost that we sense from Sparks fans that they're in kind of this private club, sort of, that no one else knows about, and that they found the you know, the entry point, the key to coming in, and they understand Sparks universe, and nobody else does outside of that, and so that it's kind of is this. Like a club, a big club. And there's, you know, just the understanding what it is that, you know, is, you know, inherent in our, like, our personalities and the lyrics that Ron writes, and the, you know, the artwork that we have on the covers and the videos that they make, that we make, that, you know, kind of it all adds up to this thing that I think Sparks fans really appreciate and think that, you know, they understand it in a great way, and they do, and that everyone else that hasn't yet discovered it, you know, like, what's your problem?
Why haven't you caught on to this?
Exactly.
Why haven't you caught on to this thing yet?
Yeah.
Do you, I really want to see your show at the Greek. Are you, do you converse with the audience in between, or do you just kind of, is it just like a start to finish? You just get right into the music.
As little as I can get away with. Yeah. No, I open my, I say, hello,
yeah.
Hello, Los Angeles. Yeah.
We kind of avoid the, we can't hear you kind of thing, you know, but.
Make some noise, Los Angeles.
I heard Los Angeles has some Sparks fans.
Yeah,
am
yeah.
I right?
Sparks in the house.
Motherfuckers, 2, 3, 4. And then you just kick
it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that.
Yeah,
sometimes
exactly.
It's just Russell giving a brief explanation of what a new song is about. That kind of thing, to try to give a entrance to what the lyric is going to be on a song that maybe a lot of people haven't heard before.
Yeah, I'm not good at the pumping up the audience style.
Hype man?
Yeah, I never
T-shirt
worked.
Cannon?
Yeah.
That's my job.
Yeah. No.
If you came out with like streamers and like the T-shirt cannons,
yeah,
it's like, wow, Sparks is going much more in a Duffman direction.
But
see, that's what I think is so great is it, I feel like because of the relationship you have with your audience, you could pretty much do anything, and I think your audience would go along with it. Go, well, that's just Sparks, and this is the that's what their moment is right now about. And I think you could get away with it.
We're really fortunate that that way, because even with our albums, a lot of bands, I think they want to make sure that they don't lose the people that are there. So
right.
They kind of have a consistency to what they've done in the past. But we know, or at least we think we know, that most Sparks fans are expecting to be challenged. And so it's a really good situation, because it gives us the freedom to kind of almost do anything. And people are hoping that we kind of have that attitude with what we're doing, and also in the live presentation as well.
You know, it seems like there's so much pressure on any creative person now to be their own marketers, especially with social media. I mean, I think the beauty is, in the old days, there were like four executives, you know, in each industry who would sort of decide, okay, this person is deemed worthy to put out, you know, that was the bottleneck. And now anyone overnight can, blow up on social media. But you are sort of fighting these invisible robots of algorithms, of getting to the audience. So it used to just be four people, but now it's like, you know, social media platforms and algorithms. But do you, I feel like you all have done a lot of marketing for yourselves for a long time. Do you feel suited for this kind of paradigm, or does it?
We're suited to have somebody else take care of that that part of it. Yeah, because social media, I mean, it's hugely, you know, important now, and you know, we have someone great doing our social media. And we kind of don't like to let it be taken over by the labels side or anything, because there's a real sensibility to what we do, and that has to be transmitted in a certain way, or it seems, you know, it just doesn't seem genuine or feel like it's coming from us. So it's a really tricky thing to do well. And so we totally recognize the importance of social media.
Most of the labels we've been through a lot of labels for various reasons that I won't go into now, but just they really have been generous, though, in the sense of kind of appreciating what we're doing and kind of giving us a lot of freedom. So you know, it's really the truth. It wasn't always like that in the past, But I think of late we've been very fortunate in that way. And even, you know, I mean, mentioned earlier just that we do work, you know, kind of really tight knit. And so there isn't somebody looking over our shoulder saying, you know, I really don't like that bass sound or something. You know, we have, you know, it's not total freedom, because we know what, you know, the general situation of what a pop song should be, you
sure.
know, but it is pretty much complete freedom.
I listened to Mad because I got an early copy of it, and I absolutely loved it. And I loved Don't Dog It. It was fantastic. I was literally sitting in a long red light when a long red light came on. running up a tab at the hotel for the Fab. Can you just talk a little bit about some, because your songs feel like very present to me. They feel very much like this was an experience that was then transformed into something creative. But I just want to hear a little bit of background on that.
Well, the weird thing is that most of our songs aren't based on something that happened to us. It's kind of more just, just kind of in thinking of a situation and then how to carry it to an extreme. There wasn't a time where one of us wanted to impress somebody by overdoing it at a hotel that they couldn't afford in order to impress a prospective partner in the future. But so it was just kind of imagining a situation and then kind of exploding it, you know. And there's a song on the album, though, that called JanSport Backpack.
Yeah.
And that one, I think, was kind of inspired by just you know, my morning jaunts in various cities and seeing that there were, you know, kind of a lot of really stylish, you know, girls wearing something that was pretty utilitarian for a long time, and just trying to figure out the image of, so how do you convert that image of somebody from the rear, and so kind of taking that somebody is continuously leaving you, and the image you have of her almost is only of that Jan Sport backpack kind of continuously, and kind of feeling, you know, just horrible about that.
No, but I love, and especially this album, your songs really are like these audio paintings that sort of like paint this very vivid image, this picture of what each song is about, so that it's, you know, it's fun to sort of get lost in the music, because it really is not synesthetic, but it definitely creates this kind of like, I see what they're talking about. Like, I do see this experience all almost visually.
Yeah, we really work in a visual kind of way. I mean, it isn't something we ever sought to go after, but it's almost cinematic sometimes, that it's important for us that it be kind of a specific situation, that our songs aren't really general, you know, the world is beautiful and you know, or I you know, just somebody.
They're not abstract.
No, exactly. I mean, you're better at words than I.
No, so. No, definitely not. But
talking
just,
about lyrics.
Yeah.
I do. You want to write the next album?
Yeah, of course I do.
Collaborate, you know. There's big money in songwriting, so. but that's really, I mean, that I think that's a really good observation, because the intent is to have them be really specific kind of images, and if there is something that's a specific kind of almost like a trivial thing, we try to make it have some kind of larger meaning than just that one thing.
Yeah. What advice would you give to people, to young artists who are just having a tough time trying to figure out, like, finding their voice, figuring out what it is they do? Do you feel like is your advice to just write no matter what? Or do you feel like it's important? Like, well, no, you got to wait for that lightning to strike and get the inspiration.
I wouldn't wait. I mean, from our experience, if you wait, then, you know, years are going to go by,
yeah.
You know? So we, even with our, I can only base it on our situation, but that inspiration has to be kind of forced, at least from our perspective. And so that, you know, that would be my advice. I mean, I don't like giving advice to people, because it's almost like if you need to get advice from somebody, then maybe it's just not right for you. You know, I mean, just, I don't know how you do it or how to get it started or anything.
But you know how you do it. So you just don't,
yeah.
I mean, if, you know, you have 28 albums, you obviously don't wait. You know, that's basically like an album every year or two, effectively. So when you're sitting down and going, okay, we're going to write, you know, we're going to do a new album. Do you break it down? Like, what's your workflow? Do you sort of break down general thematic ideas, or do you go one song at a time? How do you kind of plow through it?
Well, it's one, you know, I think it's, we in general, we don't kind of decide on what the general direction of an album should be. It's more song by song. And then, and you know, in the distant past, we always had to have a song ready, complete, rehearsal with the band, then go into an expensive studio. But we work in a different way now, at least for the past probably dozen albums, where some of the songs are written in that way, but a lot of them are just kind of done in the studio without any kind of preconception of where it's going to go. But it is kind of song by song, and there are a lot of things that, you know, early on you can kind of, we've gotten the sense now of what isn't going to work out.
Yeah.
You know? And so there's a lot of rejects, but we just kind of, we just kind of keep pushing.
How's the process changed for you, Russell?
Well, I mean, the best thing I think was when, you know, we've had it for a long time now, but when we got our own studio, when technology got to be relatively affordable and that you could do it at home, it kind of changed everything. And it's been that way now for, we've been working that way for a long time. I think it's like 15 albums we've done in my place. And it's, you know, that like Ron had mentioned in the past, you'd have to go and record with, you know, you'd be prepared, really well prepared, and go into a studio and usually with a band, and then you lay down the tracks and then you're looking at the clock, you know, we have, can we do it faster? Hurry up, because the clock's running. And then, but as a result of, you know, all the new technologies, the new technologies aren't so new anymore, but it became more, you know, available to be able to do it in your own home, and then to take as much time as you want. And as far as the quality of the work, it's really comparable to what you can do in a really huge commercial studio. And so that whole way of working completely changed for us. And we couldn't go back now and do it the other way. And we did one album, it was maybe like over about 10 years ago now with Franz Ferdinand. It was a collaboration, we were called FFS, but we recorded that in a studio. So we did go back and see what it was like to go back and work in a studio where you work, you know, we had rehearsed the songs with them. Yeah, obviously you had to be well prepared and have the songs fully structured and everything. And then you go in and you record them and, you know, and everybody, oh, better get going. We only have, you know, it's 2 weeks booked for the studio, but that was one exception. But for all of our own albums of the, you know, last 15 or so, we do it in my place. And, you know, we have a schedule and, you know, he clocks in at my place, you know, at whatever, you know, a certain time, and clocks out at, you know, 5 o'clock, and
I get some overtime.
Yes, a
little time and a half.
Yeah, and no, and we just work, and you know, and I've become more, you know, we've become more self-contained too as a result of that, where I kind of learned how to engineer as a result of having all this technology that was available to you, and thinking, God, it's an amazing opportunity. You should learn how to use all these things, like, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so we just got kind of better and better at it. And we is kind of having had too a really good education from some really amazing producers that we then felt that we could kind of do this on our own. But we, you know, we worked with like Tony Visconti, who's amazing producer of all the Bowie stuff and T-Rex. And
I've heard of him.
Yeah, he's a amazing producer and a musician and a technician as well. And then we worked with Giorgio Moroder.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, we did one album that he produced, and then 5 others that we did with his company. And Todd Rundgren was the first person to kind of, you know, give Sparks an opportunity to even record an album. And it was kind of amazing. So we've learned from really good musicians and producers kind of more of the craft side of it. And then we kind of at one point just said we felt confident enough to kind of try it on our own. And then it's sort of been that way for no looking back.
There's one thing that those people had the ability to do, was to kind of look at the material that you wrote and judge it, you know, dispassionately. So we kind of had to learn how to do that, which is really difficult. If it's your song, it's got to be a masterpiece.
Of course.
But that's really not the case. And so we think that we're able to, as best as we can, judge what songs are really cutting it, which aren't now. And that isn't something that we could do at the time. Because, you know, we, a lot of times, even with these great producers, you'd feel really hurt that they, oh, but you really don't think that's good, you know? And so, but now we kind of have to take on that role with, you know, just with the bonus of having the complete freedom to do what we're doing.
Well, that's such an interesting point too, because I think this goes back to the idea of, like, once you start to make something, if you intend on sharing with anyone, whether it's a producer or the audience, it ceases to really be necessarily about you, because you might go, I really like this hook, but then someone else goes, oh, no, I didn't even notice that. I like this whole other thing. And so, again, for people who are watching who are creative and have a very specific idea of what they want to do, how do you know when, because I feel like there are some instances where you go, you know, they told me to do this and I was like, no, we're going to do it my way. And I was right. But then there are other times where it's like, I should have listened, but I was being really stubborn. Do you just start to get a better sense, or are you not as worried about the result? Because I feel like when you release the result from your consciousness, then it kind of just lifts all that away. It's like, whatever happens, happens.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably a little bit of all of that, that you try to say you don't care what happens once it's out of your hands, but you do care. And then we're also stubborn that we say, you know, we don't want the advice, you know, we think we know for sparks what's right. And then, but then in the back of your head, you go, oh, God, I hope this is good, what we just did. So you never know. And then things surprise you too. You come out with something and then everybody says, oh, that's the song. That's the one on this album. And it's one that you thought, well, that was just,
yeah.
We like it because we put it on the album, but we didn't necessarily like it more than that other song. So you never know what people are going to respond to that you do. But the thing we have to do first is just assure ourselves that we like what we're doing and we're really committed to it. We go, we think that's really amazing. And then if other people don't respond to it in the same way, then we kind of, there's nothing we can do about that. But
yeah, well, that's where, like, when you let other people get involved and you kind of go against your gut and it doesn't work, then you're like, shh, I knew it.
Yeah.
And so I do feel like there is a lens through which you can say, well, because I've had stand-up shows where, you know, they went fine, but I did everything I set out to do. And it's like, well, I did everything I wanted to do and I just didn't necessarily connect with this audience. And then I've had other shows that went extraordinarily well where I went, oh, but I forgot to do this or I didn't. And so I think there really is that sort of like satisfying yourself, finding that balance between satisfying yourself and satisfying the audience enough so that you feel okay with it, but it's not maybe one or the other.
Yeah, I think that's more the case. And just the ideal thing is doing work that you think is, this is really amazing. I want somebody else to hear it. And they go, God, that's, I like that too. So that, but you're never assured what the reaction is going to be. But as long as you believe in what you're doing, then that's all you can do, you know? And if you try to calculate it in any way, we said that a bunch of, I think in the documentary too, that the worst thing is when you do try to bend, maybe some other suggestions that you don't really believe in or but you'll do it just to go along with that suggestion. And then it doesn't work like you mentioned. And then that's the worst of both worlds, is that you kind of didn't stick up to your principles of what you wanted to do and it didn't work either. So the most important thing we've found is just to kind of stick up to your own belief creatively. And at least in the end, you're happy with your work. And then as a bonus, it's really nice if other people like it too.
Yeah. I mean, I hope this is not apocryphal what I'm about to say, but I feel like it's accurate. I'll check it. And if it's wrong, I'll just cut it out. But then you hear those stories about like, oh, you know, Simple Minds didn't really want to do Don't You Forget About Me from the Breakfast Club soundtrack because they wanted to write their own music and they didn't write that song. But then Chrissy Hynde was supposed to do it, but then couldn't. And she was like, you should do this song. It's going to be a hit. So he was like, all right, fine, we'll do it. And then it's like, you know, like it became one of the defining songs of Generation X, you know? So I don't know. I guess it can work the other way as well.
Yeah. You read about even in film where some actor declined a role that became like an amazing, iconic role, you know, for decades, you know? And, you know, you kind of wonder what that person was thinking afterwards.
But maybe it wouldn't have been that if they were in it. You know what I mean? It's like,
no, exactly.
You really, I think there is a certain amount of, and at the beginning you mentioned like, hey, we really like to be in control. And it's difficult because there's this double-edged sword for a lot of artists today who have to really be in control of every aspect of what they're putting out, because we've all become these, like, you know, singular marketing, creative output, video makers, audio mixers, like these, we become these multi-tools. Mm-hmm. But part of having that control is knowing when to release the control. And that can be very challenging.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. And you just, you know, you don't, if there are people that are kind of looking after your, in your best interest, you kind of want to give them some respect, you know, and so, and accept what they're saying without just saying, you know what you're talking about, you know, right off the bat. So, yeah.
I do think at the end of the day, I think extracting what you said, you just have to like what you're doing and you have to be good with it no matter what. And one other thing that I'm probably going to cut out because it's embarrassing, but I'm going to ask for advice myself, but I'm asking for advice as sort of the ambassador to other people who are probably going through a similar thing. But my pandemic hobby was learning music. It was learning piano and guitar. And as an experiment, I just started writing stupid songs and working with a really nice producer and probably amassed like 24 just silly little songs. And I've never put them out and I may never release them because I am personally terrified, because the process has been so fun to make them. And what scares me is what you said earlier. It's like, of course you say, like, well, once I put them out, you can just let it go. But of course you can't.
Right, exactly.
And if people think they're stupid, or if they don't understand them, or they just don't land right, or there's just a general neutral, like, meh, I know that it's going to hurt my feelings, even though I have resisted doing that because I'm like, I'm so happy with the process up to this point. I learned a lot.
Yeah.
I got to make stuff that I'm proud of. But I'm afraid, because I'm afraid how I know I will be affected once people start reacting to it.
Tough dilemma. You should just put them out.
Do it.
Yeah. I mean, by the way,
this is not me pandering to the crowd like, I don't know, should we play another one?
There's
all the encores where it's like, they knew they were coming back out. Encore is written on the set list. Okay, well, I guess we'll come back out for two more songs. But it is a legitimate, and you know, and I look up to you guys a lot in this respect, because you never stopped, and you always kept going. And I think one of the other things that I love about your career so much is that if you had blown up in the 70s, it's very possible you could have been stuck in that moment forever and been defined by that.
Yeah.
But I think when people talk about Sparks, they look back and think about Sparks, your story is really the entirety of your career, which to me is a lot more magical than just having a moment that might have been decades old. You know, it's the sum total of all the stuff.
I think sometimes what's seen as like a brilliant creative shift was done out of desperation. People don't kind of see that that's the reason why you change stylistically. They think, oh, you were motivated creatively to do that.
But you stayed in the game, though. That's
no,
the thing.
No. Well, we didn't have a choice. We don't know how to
do anything.
We're really not good at anything. I mean, you know, people can judge us musically however they want, but we're definitely not good at anything else. So.
And do you are you at this point? Do you feel enough satisfaction, or is it still? Is it still like, I don't know, there's still like 10 more albums to write, or there's still this, or there's still the next? Are you still in the same mindset that you were pre-documentary to post-documentary?
I think it's even a better situation for the mindset, because now we know there's people out there, even because it's kind of what you were saying about your own album that you've created, not knowing, you know, like, ooh, if people are going to like it, or are they going to not like it, or, you know, any of those questions in your mind. But because of, you know, the more recent successes that we, you know, we're more, it makes you more excited to then want to produce more and to make it even better than what you've done. And so we're even more, you know, more motivated, I think, now than than ever, just to kind of, you know, keep doing what we're doing, which is kind of unlikely for a band with 28 albums to be kind of having this kind of, you know, the kind of visibility now that and I think, you know, one thing that Edgar Wright had stressed in the documentary and even to us before he started doing it was that he wanted to it was what you had just mentioned in a way, but that to stress the entire career that it was all, that it's all been a continuum, that he doesn't think of it either as like, well, there was the 70s period and, you know, and you did this, or the 80s period and you did this, that it's all of the albums had a purpose in a certain way, and leading up to where we are now. And he doesn't think that this was the golden era, or this was the golden era. And so that was one of the reasons, one of the things that really convinced us that we wanted to have this documentary done by Edgar, even though we think he's an amazing film director and all of that, but that he convinced us that he was on kind of the same page as we were, as far as the whole career having a meaning, as opposed to, you know, focusing in too tightly on one era or
right.
another era. So, and also answering the question that you were mentioning was that because we kind of, you know, got excited also about trying to find other ways of channeling what we do musically, that we had done this movie musical Annette that we mentioned earlier, but that's also kind of led us on now to wanting to kind of also do more in that area. So we have a new movie musical that we've written, and it's being directed by John Woo.
Oh, I read about that. That's pretty amazing. Yeah. Because even he was like, "Oh, this is, I'm stepping outside what I normally do." And
yeah.
So, how's that process been?
No,
so far?
It's been amazing. And we had read an article, an interview with him, saying the one thing he hadn't done yet in his career that he's always wanted to do is a movie, is a musical. And we went, John Woo, a musical? That it doesn't kind of add up. But then we said, God, and we had this project finished. And we said, we got to contact him. And then we had all the fears set in, like you were talking about your fears with your album. And all. We're going, well, what is the sensibility of Sparks and John Woo? How's that going to work? That can't possibly be that. We'll connect him. Oh, we have to play it for him. Oh, but what if he hates it? So anyway, we were lucky enough to get in touch with him. And he came over. He sat through all 2 hours of the music and the screenplay. And he said, this is amazing. It's like nothing I've ever heard before, and I want to do this. So we've been working with him for the past little over a year, kind of refining a couple of elements of the story, and we're hoping it's going to go into production soonish. So yeah, so in any case, it's just a whole other outlet for us to kind of not only do Sparks music, which we obviously love, but to kind of channel it into other areas too.
Well, I mean, it just sort of extrapolating several things that you've said, I think the answer to the question is, even just when you were talking about with John Woo, like, oh, what if, it's figuring out how to say what if, but do it anyway. What if, or what if it works out, you know, like, which is usually the what if questions are the worst.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
usually, you really have to force yourself to say, what if it works out? What if it's positive? You know, usually what if is like catastrophic.
Yeah. Yeah.
But time and time again, even if you did have those questions, you know, what I have gathered is that you just do it anyway, and you let it be what it is. And it seems like you just immediately start working on another thing and just kind of keep moving.
No.
So the momentum seems to be what carries you through rather than James Cameron style, which is like, I'm going to release one thing every 10 years.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously in his case, it worked out, but if you do one thing every 10 years and maybe it doesn't go the way you wanted, you
yeah.
might go, oh, I have failed. But if you if you do it a lot, then
yeah.
it really kind of averages out in a nice way that just kind of keeps you in the momentum.
No, that's absolutely. And it's always been a case too of when there's those periods when you're not sure, you know, things are maybe having, you know, less visibility or something, then it is always a question of to dig yourself out of those holes, is that you have to come up with something new, or else there's going to be nothing for, you know, you to show to the world. So it's always been a case of, even if you don't, you know, your things aren't going as well as you hoped, that you know, Ron would come up with a song, and that one song would just all of a sudden be a huge hit somewhere in the world. And so if, you know, if you hadn't done that at the time and you'd been kind of paralyzed, then, you know, you'd have nothing. So it's,
so just for people who are struggling, it's keep moving forward anyway. Keep figuring out how to channel your experiences into something creative, whatever it is, sculpting, yarn art, whatever it is. And then just finding ways to keep doing it, regardless of whether or not, you know, you're worried about what the result is going to be. And I think it is inhuman to think that someone could just go, well, I don't care at all. It's like, nah, you might be sociopathic. You know, it's like, if you're human, of course you're going to care. But it sounds like the best move is like, I'm going to do it anyway. And then whatever happens, I'm just going to keep going. And you kind of make that deal with yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, there isn't really any other choice.
Yeah. You might feel that, but you do make the choice. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like,
I mean,
for whatever reason, we're always motivated at a minimum. I mean, so even if nothing seems to be happening, we do feel a drive all the time. And, you know, I think sometimes after having 28 albums, you know, you kind of, you know, is that going to, you know, but that's the one thing I have faith in, that isn't going to kind of disappear from us.
So as we're sort of wrapping this up, are there specific elements to the tour that you look forward to? You mentioned being a tourist. Are there things, it could be within the show, moments in each show, the process of traveling, something is, Russell, I'll just ask you first, and then Ron, what is something that really excites you about, you know, getting ready to go on tour?
No, I mean, it really is the thing of just connecting with this whole group of people that come to see you, and they're coming to see you for what you've created, you know, and then to make them happy. You know, you see these faces and just smiling and kind of some point going crazy over what you've done. I mean, you know, there's nothing kind of more satisfying than that, to see that after all the kind of the work that you put into it, that it's connecting with people, you know, and a lot of people. And so there's nothing. And then to see it connecting that way all around the world. So, you know, we go to Japan a lot. We've been playing a lot in Japan in the last 20 years it's been now. And the audience has been building, getting bigger and bigger in Japan. So to see that, you know, you're creating something here in, you know, West LA, and then in Japan, there's people kind of, you know, just reacting crazy to what you're doing. There's, you know, nothing more kind of satisfying than that.
What about you, Ron?
Well, I mean, I was going to mention that same thing. I mean, it's ripping them off as usual, but just the universality of what you're doing, how it reaches, you know, you're playing in Japan or you're playing Mexico City, and there's kind of the same look of joy on people's faces, and young people, you know, it's kind of a miracle, really. And we didn't always have that, and that's something I think that's different for us in the past, I don't know, 10 years or so, because early on, the audiences were kind of, you know, really regional wherever you would play. And so material had to be kind of, the set list had to be kind of shaped to each country. And so, you know, when we lived in England, you know, we had done really well there in the 70s, and we came back to LA and played some songs that were kind of monster songs there, and they didn't go over, and you kind of are puzzled, but that kind of thing wouldn't happen now. And so, you know, it's really just miraculous to see that what you're doing is reaching people everywhere. I'm trying to avoid thinking of another thing to tell you.
But that does make a lot of sense, especially, you know, in the, one of the positive things of social media, you know, is that it has localized in a way so that it's not like, oh, what they're doing is wildly different than what we're, it's like everyone has access to pretty much everything. And so you're sort of able to tour the globe like a neighborhood.
No, I mean, there is the downside of that kind of a homogenization, of some kind of things where regional kind of strengths in music or something are maybe kind of being whittled down a little, because I really like, you know, regional music, like Okinawa has their own kind of music, you know, and so, but you hope that can kind of keep going, despite the fact that I also like the thing that things are now kind of universal in what you say, even language-wise, it almost, you know, we kind of put so much stock in lyrics, but the songs are reaching people on another level, and that's really inspiring to us, where people that don't even know what you're talking about, they can get something of the message, you know, partly from the music, but probably just even the tone of what you're saying.
So last question, I'm a big breakfast person. Do you guys like breakfast? And what is your ideal breakfast?
I love breakfast.
What's your
idea? Well, that's kind of a regional thing too, because in LA I have to have, you know, fruit salad and you know, some kind of cereal granola or something and yogurt.
So that's some texture.
Kinda, yeah, texture. You gotta have a texture to work against the fruit salad. But then when you go to other countries, I just, you know, we kind of, like we mentioned earlier, we're such good tourists, but I like going out, you know, and having breakfast in other countries, and you know, they're, you know, nothing like the French baguette and dunking that in your you know, cafe au lait in the morning. And then you're in Japan, and Japan's got in the coffee places there, they all have it's called morning sets. And so it's the A-setto, B-setto, or C-setto. And they're different things. You know, you could get a, you know, some egg thing with, and they always have a little tiny salad. Mm-hmm. This is for breakfast. And, or you can get some other thing as the B-setto.
Breakfast salad, all right.
Yeah, breakfast salads. The Japanese, they've come up with it again. So anyway, yeah. So it depends on what part of the world you're in, but just the basic thing is the fruit salad, granola, and yogurt.
Ron, do you have a...
Well, I mean, in keeping with my bland personality, I'm an oatmeal man. So.
There's another, like, plain oatmeal, or there's kind of like a little maple syrup?
Well, I mean, I like a little bit of sugar-free maple syrup on
sure.
the top. But kind of like no butter, just... oatmeal, and so it's hard to find in a lot of places, but
also oatmeal, if you're ordering it in a restaurant, it's really hard to, that it's inconsistent, that it'll come hot, you know, and the worst thing is having the oatmeal where it's kind of lukewarm,
like Oliver Twist style, where you get like gruel, you're like, oh, this is cold.
Yeah. And you got to send it back, and then you know, my oatmeal really isn't good yet.
And they stick it in the microwave, and then we'll teach them a lesson.
It goes back molten.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you like your oatmeal?
It burned several layers off the roof of my mouth. I asked for this.
I prefer that to kind of cold oatmeal.
Okay, good. I don't know why. I'm just fast. I love breakfast. It's my favorite meal.
What is your thing?
So there's two things, really. It's some, you know, if I'm going more traditional, eggs over medium, bacon or turkey bacon, toast, fruit instead of the potatoes. But I'm a big ham and cheese guy, so I will systematically find, just to your point about regionality, is finding a version of a ham and cheese sandwich everywhere. So, you know, maybe in Italy it's panini, it's a jumbo fromage, and, you know, in Canada or France, or, you know, so it's just finding different versions of you know, basically a grilled ham and cheese sandwich.
Yeah.
So that's what, and if it's breakfast, I'll do that, but throw some egg on there. So that's kind of it.
Sounds good.
Respect.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming and being here in person. And I adore you both. And I love the album Mad! Exclamation point. It comes out May, is it 23rd?
I think that's the day.
Yeah, May 23rd. And I absolutely loved it. I listened to start to finish the way we used to listen to albums in the 1900s. None of this singles.
No.
I took the journey. I recommend taking the journey.
Thank you. Yeah. We totally agree with you. Yeah. Meant to be listened to as a whole.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And best of luck with the tour. And I honestly, please, let's get together and talk every time you do an album.
Thank you.
Okay.
We'll
go to
breakfast. Yeah.
Okay. See you in 2 years. It'll be like 18 months, you guys.
No, it was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
it's good to see you both.
You too. Yeah. Thank you.
Now, I thought that episode had a perfectly good ending. However, I recorded that before I came up with what I think is probably the catchiest catchphrase in the history of podcast catchphrases. So I think I got to just end this the way we established in the Ben Schwartz episode, to just remind you to just move forward and to not get in your head about stuff. And when you start just getting in these kind of thought clouds that just start, crowding your brain and keeping you from progressing in any direction. So I just simply got to say, stop it there, you. Smooth.